A very good morning to everyone. Our first case this morning is number 05-3127, John R. Talmadge against Charles B. Harris. Mr. Van Camp.
Good morning. May it please the court, Mr. Johnson. As you are aware, this is a case that Mr. Talmadge prevailed on at trial. Mr. Harris brought a case for legal malpractice that was involved in insurance bad faith as the underlying claim. The jury agreed in this case that the insurance company had committed bad faith and that Mr. Harris had failed to bring the claim within the time permitted by the statute of limitations. In spite of winning at trial, Mr. Talmadge brings this appeal because of a number of rulings made by the trial judge during the trial process. Beginning simply chronologically, the trial court in this case made a ruling at the final pretrial conference on a motion in limine. The motion in limine was brought to exclude damages that were not recovered by Mr. Talmadge in the insurance settlement. The motion was brought on claim preclusion grounds. Claim preclusion wasn't considered by the court, and instead the court ruled that because Mr. Talmadge was not intending to call an expert witness, he would not be able to prove those damages. At the conclusion of this trial and in the motions after verdict, the judge in the case determined that this was not a case that under Wisconsin law required an expert witness. Instead, the judge concluded that this was a case that was within the ordinary knowledge and experience of the normal juror, and as a result, expert witnesses were not required. In spite of that, in the preliminary pretrial conference, she excluded these damage testimony. There was substantial credible evidence that would have been offered to support these damages. Mr. Talmadge was hired by the insurance company to repair his fire-damaged facility.
But I thought there were all sorts of gaps, if you will, in the evidence, in the sense that, yes, on your theory, they decided not to have an outside company or person come assess this, and they said, you may do the work yourself and submit us the receipts and the hours and all the rest. But their point has some force, I think, in saying this can't possibly have been a blank check. I mean, you want to know kind of before and after. What were the facilities? What materials were there? How big was it? What equipment was lost? What was replaced? And just simply saying, you know, I've decided to spend this week, surely not enough.
I don't disagree with that. In this case, the defendants have argued repeatedly that there wasn't substantial or sufficient documentation.
Of the before as well as the repair, I guess that's what I'm wondering about, because I understand that he submitted statements about, you know, which people worked and how much he was assessing their time worth and what, at least as I understand it, what materials he was using in the course of the repair. But I guess that doesn't fully answer the question whether this is really repair or improvement or what is it?
Okay, that's an issue of fact that certainly the insurance company would have an opportunity to raise if they had any evidence that he, for example, repaired it so that it was in better condition than it was before, or that he put more lifts in than he had before, or that he had done anything to the facility to improve it or increase its capacity or anything like that. There isn't any evidence of that at all. And in fact, what happened here was, as you pointed out, the insurance company agreed to pay him to do the cleanup and the restoration on an hourly or time and materials basis. He submitted his time and his invoices for materials. And they are contending, I mean, they never hired a contractor or anyone to say that any particular time that he spent was not spent on restoration. They didn't hire a contractor to point out a single expense that he submitted that wasn't appropriate for restoration. What they did instead was they they essentially set a trap. They said to him, we will pay you on a time and materials basis. He then spent his time and his money cleaning up the facility and repairing it to its pre-fire condition. They have never taken a position in this case that he did anything other than that. Now, when he submitted his bills, they waited until July, and the restoration, the fire was in April, the restoration was 80% completed by the end of July. At that time, they hired an accountant to take a look at the bills and things that he had submitted, and if you look at her report, it's an amazing report because it itemizes all of the bills that he did in fact submit.
Well, but I guess there comes a point where they have paid him $309,000 and some dollars.
Right.
$309,366, your opponents say. And somebody is looking at it and they say, wait a minute, we need to look at this more carefully, and then eventually he gets another chunk of money. So he gets in the settlement another 114, right?
That's correct.
So he winds up with a lot of money, and I guess I'm concerned about where's the documentation that the actual restoration. Why wasn't the district judge right to say, before you can say this was inadequate, you need somebody qualified to speak to it?
Okay. The point is that Mr. Talmadge was qualified to speak to it.
But he's an interested party. I mean, I guess,
The insurance company is also an interested party. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to.
No, go ahead. Please.
The insurance company is also an interested party. And in this case, the insurance company has never said that the bills he submitted or the time that he submitted was inappropriate for the restoration effort. And I'm glad you brought up the appraisal reports, because the basis of the insurance company's rejection, if you will, of his claims are the appraisal reports. Those were admitted in this case over the objection of the
right.
plaintiff, and they were admitted clearly to prove the truth of their of the information that they contained. Because
but wasn't there an instruction from the judge to, or actually, never mind. I thought the judge said they were being admitted to show the state of mind, if you will, of the insurance company that they were getting other opinions, and so they were not behaving in bad faith to think that this was too much money.
The point is that the contents of those writings had to be taken into account by the insurance company. They had to rely on them. In this case, all of the people who prepared those reports were alive and could come in and testify as to whether or not they were reasonable. The particular one that the insurance company relied on was an appraisal that was done after the facility was repaired. So the person who came in to do that was hired by an insurance company to come in and do it at a point in time when they had no obligation to hire anybody for that amount of money to do the work. And did they bring that person in as a witness to demonstrate that it was reasonable, to demonstrate what his experience was, what his expertise was? No, they didn't. They simply relied on it, and then it was introduced for, they claim, for purposes of showing the state of mind
right.
of the insurance company, but the state of mind of the insurance company had already been determined that they weren't going to pay the amount that Mr. Talmadge had submitted. Keep in mind that they never once paid Mr. Talmadge on a time and materials basis. They submitted what they called advances up to the tune of $125,000 in the first 3 months. $125,000 sounds like a lot of money unless you spend $500 or very close to $500. So they had paid only $125 of the $400-plus bills that had been submitted by Mr. Talmadge through August. And so we have September, October, November, December, January, February, and so forth, where there were interest charges being charged to him for loans that he made and bills that he put on his insurance card, and then finally, a year after the fire, they brought that level up to $300,000, and then it was 3 years after the fire before they paid an additional amount.
After the appraisal proceeding, right?
After the appraisal. After the appraisal proceeding. But it's evident that they were not intending to pay him in the way that they said. And I think that it's, if you look at his bills being submitted and them looking at those bills, they never once said to him, okay, we've looked at the bills and we need this and this and this. They simply wrote him a blanket statement and said, we don't have enough documentation to pay you. I mean, it had to be maddening to him to try to figure out what they had. So he resubmitted bills, not knowing what they were missing. And again, they didn't tell him what they were missing. Now, on this documentation side, once he submitted his proof of claim, that was a year from the fire, there was documentation. There is no evidence that the insurance company ever looked at that proof of loss. He submitted a proof of loss that listed all of his claims and that was supported by invoices and credit card bills and everything needed to make the payments. The insurance company had both his original invoices in the months that he was doing the work and then later had the proof of loss, and they never once said, let's go through this and determine which ones we think are unreasonable. They simply stopped payments. Now, what they did here was they agreed to pay him on a time and materials basis. They never did that. They changed the methodology. They didn't use appraisal reports that were done at a point in time when they could have gone out to look for a contractor to do the work. They couldn't find a contractor to do the work. This is in northern Wisconsin during the construction season. He did the work, and he was told in no uncertain terms that they would pay him hourly. He spent his money. He put the charges on credit cards. He incurred vast amounts of interest in order to pay this, and then he didn't receive the payments that they said they were going to make to him. Now, in terms of punitive damages, it seems to me if ever there was a bad faith case where punitive damages are appropriate is this one. The insurance company intentionally disregarded his interests, and they were practically certain to know that he would be damaged by their conduct. By the time they fired Mr. Holt, the original adjuster, and hired Mr. Stensrud in the fall of 95, Mr. Stensrud ignored Mr. Holt's agreement to pay on a time and materials basis. He ignored their own accountant, who they hired as an expert to determine what payments, bills had been submitted and so forth. She said that that time and materials was an appropriate method. He completely ignored that. He hired an adjuster. They did the appraisal report after the repairs had been made and then never looked back at the time and materials. They didn't look at the time and materials after the proof of loss was in, and throughout the period of time that it took to set up this appraisal hearing, they never addressed those. Now, this case, as you know, was also filed in the state court by Mr. Harris. Mr. Harris brought a claim in that case for both the contract insurance claim as well as the bad faith claim. Mr. Harris protected the bad faith claim when he settled the case. He had a contract that was never dismissed on the bad faith claim. Mr. Harris understood very clearly that it was his responsibility to bring that. In this case, the trial court not only refused to allow the jury to consider interest and the original amount of damages that he was not able to get at the appraisal hearing, in spite of the fact that his testimony was that Mr. Harris assured him that he could get this in the bad faith claim. But the court also then, on the other side, admitted these appraisal reports, which were highly prejudicial because the jury had absolutely no evidence other than these appraisal reports of what should have been paid to Mr. Talmadge. Nothing in the record suggests that anything that he was paid shouldn't have been paid.
Could you remind me, when he makes his first agreement with Mr. Holt, who shows up right after this loss,
right,
and Holt says time and materials, in what place or places is that agreement with the insurance company reduced to writing?
That agreement is never reduced.
It's never reduced to writing, is
no.
it? So
no.
We don't know whether it's unlimited. We don't know whether there's some reasonableness limitation. We don't know much about it other than kind of an oral time and agreements, time and materials.
That's correct. And it's unfortunate for all of us that it wasn't reduced
to writing. Yes, here you are today.
That's right. I mean, I think that's an important point, though, because clearly the insurance company has a great deal more experience dealing with fire losses and damages of this sort than Mr. Tomich does. Mr. Tomich has a good business, and all he's concerned about is getting his business back up and running. And so when he can't find a contractor that will bid on the whole thing, he finds one that will bid on a little bit, but he doesn't find somebody that will bid on the whole thing, so he offers to do it himself, and they agreed to do that. Now, it seems to me that in the absence of a clear written agreement that says you will do it on time and materials and you will submit certain documentation and you will receive payment within a certain number of
right.
days, that the Wisconsin rule regarding, and I know this court has some difficulty with the duty of good faith under Wisconsin contract law, but it has been addressed. And clearly there is a good faith obligation by contracting parties. And in this case, when they tell him to submit his bills, then they have an obligation to pay those bills within a reasonable time under this good faith obligation in a contract. And I think that's they didn't do that in this case. And that's what led to the interest charges. That's what led to him having to sell the business in order to pay off the credit card debt. And I think that for a common juror to understand the concept of an agreement to pay on a time and materials basis and to understand that by waiting months and months and months and in many cases years to pay for those time and materials bills, which have been submitted on a timely basis. He said he submitted them every time he got a bunch together. How often was this? Monthly, weekly? He said sometimes it started out weekly and then it would get, you know, monthly or something. They had an obligation to pay those within a reasonable time. It was not reasonable to instead say, well, we've changed the method of valuing this. Now that we know how much money you've spent, we're going to value this on the basis of an appraisal. And, oh, by the way, the fellow who's doing the appraisal knows that the construction is 80% complete, and he knows he's not going to have to find somebody who will do it for that. The insurance company never came to either trial or to Mr. Tomich and said, we have somebody that will do it for the amount of the appraisal report. That never happened. After they received the proof of loss, they didn't go through the proof of loss and say to him, this charge for time is unreasonable, this charge for a lift or for tools or something is unreasonable. They simply said, this is what our appraisal says, and that's what we're sticking with. Had they done that in the beginning, he would have had the opportunity to say, I can't do it for that. We can have somebody else find a contractor to repair it. And once again, don't we wish that would have happened? But it didn't happen. And in this case, because they changed the method on him, and because they never would say to him, we didn't receive documentation for any particular thing, he had no possibility of resolving the dispute with the insurance company because he had already spent his money on the understanding that they were going to pay him on that basis. I think that the fact that he subsequently submitted a proof of loss and that they had all of the documentation apparently that they needed at that time is important. It's also important to notice that he submitted that in May, I believe, of 96 or the summer of 96, and the appraisal hearing in this case didn't take place until 98. And, in fact, Harris, while he was still representing him, had to sue United Fire to get them to do the appraisal hearing. So they not only changed the method of accounting, but they also wouldn't sit down and do the appraisal hearing until he brought a suit to require them to do that. At every step of this, after Mr. Holt made his agreement and Mr. Talmadge spent his money, he didn't get paid. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Van Camp. We'll hear now from Mr. Johnson.
Thank you. What Mr. Van Camp has just done is what we heard during the trial proceedings repeatedly, and that is a discussion of the case as if there were no rules, as if there were no limits, as if the issues were not defined. Because, for example, no one ever said that the insurance company acted in bad faith by delaying the appraisal hearing. As a matter of fact, Mr. Camp attempted to introduce that argument in the district court. The district court judge rejected it. It never went to the jury. There never was any such claim, and yet it is still being argued here. That is the problem with this case. That has been the problem with Mr. Talmadge's approach from the beginning. What the district court did from the proceedings immediately before the trial, through the trial, to the end of the trial, was properly apply rules of evidence, rules of law, rules of proof, test Mr. Talmadge's case against those rules, and unfortunately for Mr. Talmadge, fortunately for my clients, in most cases found those wanting. The perfect example is the first issue which Mr. Van Camp raised with you, the $135,000 or whatever it is of unproven damages. Those damages are of two types. One are damages that he was prepared to at least attempt to prove at the appraisal hearing because they were included within his proof of loss. He didn't go to the appraisal hearing. He settled his contract claim at the outset of the appraisal hearing with Mr. Harris's advice and assistance, and no one ever claimed Mr. Harris was negligent in the way he handled that.
Well, I suppose the claim is that the appraisal settlement was the contract claim, as you just said. And now the question is, did Mr. Harris's handling of the bad faith claim somehow prevent Mr. Talmadge from getting the rest of that money? You know, statements were being made, oh, well, you can pick that up with the bad faith
precisely,
claim.
Precisely, except there was no testimony that if Mr. Harris said that, that was negligence, and even Mr. Talmadge doesn't claim that the legal malpractice case didn't require expert testimony to establish the standard of care and a failure to meet it. And there was no testimony in the trial that, regardless of this dispute between Mr. Talmadge and Mr. Harris about what he was told about what his remedies would be, that anything Mr. Harris said was negligent. So even if Mr. Van Camp thinks it was negligent, in all honesty, even if you think it was negligent, it is not an issue in the case, because everyone has conceded that on the malpractice side of things, we do need an expert to say, if Mr. Harris said that to his client, that was negligence, and Mr. Bohock never said that. So you can't conclude, and the district court properly did conclude, that you can't allow Mr. Talmadge to recover monies he could have recovered in the appraisal because he decided he could recover them in the bad faith claim, when in fact you can't recover them in the bad faith claim. They're not a proper measure of damages. It is theoretically possible that Mr. Talmadge could have put in a case to prove that. He could have had an expert to say, if what Mr. Talmadge says is correct, and if Mr. Harris told Mr. Talmadge, you can recover these damages that we compromised on in the contract claim, in the bad faith claim, that advice was negligent and it caused him damages. And if they had had that claim, had that testimony, we would have had someone to contest it and the jury would have decided it. We never got to that point because the district court concluded, you don't have any testimony to show it was negligent. You can't just get up and argue that a lawyer was negligent without an expert witness to say this conduct is negligent. That doesn't work. Secondly,
well, that's, I mean, you're arguing, I think, from a general proposition of Wisconsin law, that whether it's medical malpractice or legal malpractice or whatever kind of malpractice, you need an expert to come in and testify to the standard of care.
Correct.
Right.
And Mr. Talmadge has never argued otherwise. He didn't argue otherwise in the district court, and he hasn't raised it as an issue in this appeal. He just magically wants you to give him his $83,000 without having any recognized legal theory under which you can award it.
Well, how would you think he should go about establishing this standard of care? Certainly, blowing the statute of limitations is pretty obvious.
I don't think it is pretty obvious. It depends on what we had an expert witness who said that Mr. Harris wasn't negligent. It was an issue for the jury to decide. They decided it adversely to us. We disagree with that, but we concede there was ample evidence to support that finding. We don't challenge it.
Right, and so that finding, that much, if that were the issue, if it were just about missing a statute of limitations,
there would be no appeal.
Yeah, there's no appeal because that's the kind of thing that there was enough evidence in this record to support that. So you really
and we didn't contest Mr. Bohawk's qualifications at minimum to opine on the legal malpractice issue. We did contest his qualifications to opine on the bad faith issue, which is, I think, really the central issue.
The underlying issue, right, as to whether something about what Mr. Harris, the opportunity that Mr. Harris missed, maybe is a way of thinking about it, in fact, showed bad faith. Could he have proven a bad faith claim and thereby recovered these damages, right?
Correct.
Isn't that the question?
We think the central issue in this case is not whether Mr. Bohawk was qualified. He absolutely was not. If Mr. Bohawk is qualified to be an expert on what is bad faith in handling a fire loss claim, then every lawyer in the state of Wisconsin is qualified to testify as an expert on that subject because he knows nothing about it, absolutely
nothing. Well, Mr. Bohawk's the lawyer who lectures on these things, right?
He has been paid periodically by a seminar for hire group to testify or give lectures on bad faith cases. Although he's never handled a bad faith case, he's never written on bad faith, he's never handled a fire loss claim. Now, I don't know what your experience has been in going to seminars, and I mean no disrespect to Mr. Bohawk, but I've heard some pretty boneheaded things said in legal seminars because there simply isn't any quality control. There's no requirement that you demonstrate you know what you're talking about. Someone just has to be willing to put you up on the rostrum and speak. This is a classic example. Mr. Bohawk is not qualified to opine on fire loss bad faith claims. The district court gave them every chance to prove he was and ultimately concluded that when she let him opine on those subjects, she erred. That ruling is correct. Otherwise, the decision in this case will say any lawyer, regardless of his contact or lack of contact with bad faith claims, can testify as an expert on bad faith. I don't think that's a particularly good rule of law, but that will be the rule of law that will come from this if you accept their position. That's why I think the real question here is, were these issues complex enough that a jury which didn't have Mr. Bohawk's opinion testimony, which of course they heard and they didn't know the court was going to decide later that was an error, could they decide the bad faith issues in Mr. Talmadge's favor without an expert? And the answer to that, of course, is no, because the only case that says you can do that is the Weiss case, which involves an insurer refusing to pay anything in the face of obvious indications that their position was wrong. For example, they were refusing to pay on the basis of arson when the fire chief's report said it wasn't arson. Now, a juror can judge that and decide, is that really bad faith conduct? Is that beyond the pale without an expert?
But personally, the judge does decide that, first of all, I think you're dealing with abuse of discretion review here, and secondly, she says that the jury was able, under these circumstances, to make that decision based on the lay testimony in front of
it. I don't think we're dealing with an abuse of discretion. You're dealing with the question of a legal issue, that is, can a prima facie case be made under these circumstances without expert testimony? That's a legal issue to which you owe no deference to the trial court. Second of all, this is a complex question. For example, when an arrangement is made between an insurer and an insured that because of difficulties in getting a contractor, you can undertake to do the repairs on a time and material basis, and the insured presents this set of documentation, and the insurer says, contrary to what Mr. Van Camp argued, repeatedly in personal meetings and in correspondence, this simply isn't good enough. We can't make heads or tails out of what you're giving us, and some of it is inherently suspect. For example, the fire occurred on a Monday night going into Tuesday morning. Mr. Talmadge was out of town, didn't get back, my memory is, until either Tuesday night or Wednesday morning. He billed them for 40 hours that week. Now, if you were on the insurance company and you got billed 40 hours for a week when the fire didn't even occur until Tuesday morning, and the guy who's charging for it doesn't even show up till Tuesday night or Wednesday, and then charged 40 hours at a mythical rate of $42 an hour, which Mr. Talmadge admitted he just pulled out of the sky, might not you question it? I would. How can a jury say, without expert testimony, that an insurance company questioning that payment is bad faith? How can an insurance company say that an insurance company hiring an outside accountant and an outside an adjuster because their in-staff employees can't get anywhere with Mr. Talmadge and have developed a personality conflict with him for whatever reason, that that act is bad faith?
Well, I mean, the jury obviously perhaps gives some credence to the idea that the insurance company did not, in fact, point out to Mr. Talmadge the particular flaws. I mean, it's his own business. It doesn't seem to me inconceivable that he could have spent 40 hours working on it, even in the balance of the week. People don't work eight-hour days necessarily in their
but
own.
That doesn't mean that questioning it is an act of bad faith.
No, but the jury's looking at the case as a whole, surely.
When Wisconsin law makes it clear that to prove bad faith, you have to prove something more than breaching the insurance contract.
Right.
You have to prove something more than negligence. You have to prove
he
did something
complain.
That's beyond the pale.
Sure, but I take it there were no complaints about the jury instructions on that point. The jury was told you have to prove more than just...
The complaint was that the issue should not go to the jury because Mr. Bohock is unqualified.
That's what you're saying, but it did go to the jury, of course.
Well, you asked me if there was any complaint, and I was telling you what our complaint
right,
was.
But you weren't particularly picking apart the instructions and saying
no.
The jury is being told it can find bad faith just by a mere breach of contract, and in fact it should have been told that the burden is higher. Nothing
no.
like that.
But in the face of testimony that said we paid him $300,000 within a year, and then we compromised, United Fire compromised, not we, compromised the claim later for an amount about midway between where they were and where the insured was, how does a jury with no information from any expert as to what a reasonable insurance company would do, what normal claims handling practices are, how normal insurance companies deal with these problems, how do they evaluate whether that conduct evinced an intentional or knowing or reckless disregard of the insured's rights so as to constitute bad faith? I don't think it does, and I think the district court erred in concluding that it did. If I can move back to the first point that was raised, because there's a couple of other issues here, I think, to show how far afield we have gotten factually from the facts. The second part of this initial damage claim that Mr. Van Camp called for, that he wants to recover, are claims that were never presented to the insurance company. Mr. Talmadge, after the settlement was made, for the next several years up to the trial, continued to just accrue. Every time a light bulb would burn out, he'd add it to the list because he heard someplace that if you have smoke in an industrial building, it can affect the light fixtures. And so if this light bulb burned out 3 years after the fire, I'm putting down replacing it as an item of damages. That's what they wanted to put in front of the jury for almost half of that amount of money that the court excluded at the beginning of the trial. The court said, wait a second. Number one, you have to have expert testimony. And the court did say you had to have expert testimony. Mr. Van Camp, I think, by slip of the tongue, erred by telling you the judge said this case didn't require expert testimony.
He's comparing, of course, the two parts of the case, where the judge at the end, for the part that you're complaining about, says it was not beyond the jury's ability to determine this, and he's saying, well, if it wasn't beyond the jury's ability for that purpose, why was it beyond the jury's ability for the other purpose?
And I think the answer to both of those questions is it was beyond the jury's ability, but the question here is, could the average juror determine that a light bulb that burned out 3 years after the fire, with no expert testimony that it had anything to do with the fire, no expert testimony as to what the total cost of the repair of the building was, is a compensable item of damages? And Judge Crabb said, you have to have an expert to come in here and say, this is what it cost to repair the building in total. This is my opinion. This is what it cost to fix all the fire damage. This is what Mr. Talmadge got. He's entitled to get the difference. And she asked Mr. Van Camp, do you have such an expert? And Mr. Van Camp said, no, I don't. And she said, then you can't prove that claim. Similarly, on the interest, the evidence was absolutely clear that some of the interest that was claimed had nothing to do with this. Their own experts said some of it had nothing to do with it. But that's not the main point. The main point is no one ever said at the trial that any specific amount of money should have been paid to Mr. Talmadge at any point in time when it wasn't paid. All Mr. Bohock said, all the plaintiff ever argued is, he should have been paid more faster.
Well, but I mean, he's arguing that there's a reasonable time period, and I would think one could go back and look at the credit card records and the other records to see which are expenses attributable to the repair work and which are, let's say, more personal expenses.
Except there never was any proof as to when they were asked to be paid. There never was any time frame. I can't compute. No one can compute an interest component without knowing what's the day the amount should have been paid in
so
the exercise.
So you don't have the submissions to the insurance company? Here's what I'd like to be paid this month?
No, none of those were tied to the credit cards.
What was Mr. Holt doing all this time?
Well, Mr. Holt was doing all this time. Well, first of all, Mr. Holt wasn't on the risk all of this time. Mr. Holt was on it from the beginning until, I would guess, about the first 6 months or so. My memory is not absolutely clear on that. And then because the insurance company was unhappy with the fact the claim wasn't being resolved and there were all these issues, they hired an outside adjuster to replace him, and Mr. Stensrud handled the claim from that point forward.
Well, were they monitoring as things went along?
Absolutely. Why
were there any surprises?
I don't know what you mean by surprises, John.
Where did all this come up? Weren't they watching as it went along and getting some sort of assessment of the improvements? And
yes, and when they would get this, they would call Mr. Talmadge and say, we need to sit down and talk to you about this. We need to set up a meeting. The record is clear. There were several meetings where they sat down with Mr. Talmadge, and he said, I decided I don't want to meet with you today. I'm mad at you guys. I'm not going to talk about this, or I'm not going to give you the records today.
So he rejected the opportunity to...
In some instances. He usually, as most rational people would when he got over his snit, recanted and tried to put the material together. But it was a two steps forward, one step back process from the very beginning, including when the accountants told him there was material that was needed. On the punitive damage issue, the one point I want to emphasize, which was contained in our brief, is that the only act that would justify punitive damages against Mr. Harris that was even argued to justify it was the fact that Mr. Van Camp and his client objected to the fact that when Mr. Harris closed the file after the statute of limitations had probably run, he didn't tell Mr. Talmadge that.
His letter just said, I don't think there's anything to this case, right?
And Mr. Harris had his explanation for that, and I don't know what the jury would have thought of it. But the key point is this. Wisconsin law requires that in order to be awarded punitive damages because of an act or omission by a defendant, that act or omission has to have been a cause of compensatory damages. There never was any claim advanced, no argument advanced. There can be no argument advanced that failing to tell Mr. Talmadge after the statute of limitations had run, that the statute of limitations had run, damaged him. That act, even if we were somehow to characterize it as justifying punitive damages, can't justify punitive damages because it didn't cause any compensatory damages. And Wisconsin law is clear. It is not disputed, I think. You can't get punitive damages for conduct, however wrongful it might be, unless that act caused compensatory damages. And that simply doesn't fit here. Similarly, with the insurance company, there never was any explanation as to how their conduct could result in anything other than, at the absolute worst, bad faith. There's no characterization of the evidence. Judge Crabb went through this at length, the transcript reflects, with Mr. Van Camp, and there simply was no reason articulated for why a jury could find that this conduct not only was bad faith, but went beyond it to somehow constitute a basis for awarding punitive damages. So she was correct in that regard. The last point I want to make about the evidence. The court reduced the damage award by the jury on motions after verdict. She did that, I believe, clearly in the decision she rendered, by understanding and appreciating that the same basis which applied to exclude the interest claim necessarily excluded the claim for the loss of the value of the business. Because the theory was the same. In both instances, the claim was that because you didn't pay me money when I should have, I was damaged and suffered in one case interest, in the other case, I was forced to sell the business. What Judge Crabb concluded, properly so, is that because the plaintiff never put in enough evidence from which the jury could compute the interest, it necessarily followed. The jury could not have made any conclusion other than pure guesswork about the effect of this delay in payment on Mr. Talmadge's sale of his business, particularly where Mr. Talmadge's own testimony made it clear he had all kinds of other financial pressures. He had lots of uninsured losses that have nothing to do with the insurance company, nothing to do with bad faith. I see my yellow light is on. I want to close with one comment. I think the only issue which is even worthy of serious consideration on this appeal is the question of whether, under the Weiss case, the jury was should have been allowed to address the bad faith issue without expert testimony. Because I don't think anyone could look at Mr. Bohawk's credentials and believe that he was an expert qualified to address the bad faith issue. We have to look at these issues one by one as requires expert testimony. If you conclude that that's the case should be remanded to the district court with instructions that it be dismissed, that the judgment be vacated, and that we recover our costs. If you believe that under Weiss, you didn't need expert testimony for the bad faith verdict in this case, then the verdict should be sustained, the judgment should be sustained as amended. There simply isn't any basis to change what the district court did on any other issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Sir, your time had expired, so the case will be taken under advisement. Our thanks to both counsel.